Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this June the 18th on the West Coast, now June the 19th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome all those listening in also on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world and on BlogTalkRadio.com. This is one of my favorite parts of the week. Actually, I enjoy every night of the week when I'm doing a show. Of course, tonight's guest is a regular on the show and has been for soon to be 3 years straight. And he is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher. I have nominated him. No one's actually argued this nomination as Evident Footprints resident science advisor, and with good reason. And tonight we're going to be talking about some misconceptions in the sciences, and we're going to get sort of a primer for those listeners out there that wonder why we say we're not being told the truth about certain things and why certain technologies are suppressed and that whole ball of wax. So without further ado, I welcome back to the show my good friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, good evening, and I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well, Don, and it's a pleasure to be with you as usual. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
I practiced it all day, so. Oh, my goodness. Well, I know that there are a lot of things that we say, probably I say and others that talk about science that don't know a hill or, you know, they don't know their rear end from a hole in the ground, we could say. And certainly when we start talking about things like energy and power and the various applications, and we try to make sense out of what's going on in the world, there's a lot of confusing information. And I know you're here to set the record straight tonight on that once and for all. So I'm going to turn the mic over to you and listen to what you have to impart to our listeners and to myself.
Well, I don't know about setting the record straight once and for all, but I will say this. I have been involved in energy and power research for 42 years. And I started that procedure of investigation, you know, right after I finished my education. And I took 2 years of college physics in high school, along with advanced mathematics and a few other exciting subjects, just so that I would have what I thought was a worthwhile foundation in anticipation of furthering myself in these fields once I entered college. And I was always under the impression, perhaps erroneously, that most people that decided to enter into physics, engineering, or the hard sciences had the same attitude as me when it comes to the passion with which you apply yourself. And I've actually been proven very wrong in that assumption over the years, because a lot of people wind up with a degree and they just, I don't know exactly what terms to use, but they just kind of coast after that. Then you have another phylum of characters, which profess to be researchers and investigators into various aspects of science. The one you hear most often, perhaps, at least in the circles that I move in, are the so-called free energy investigators or the free energy researchers. And I would have to say, unfortunately, that it is from that particular group that you hear the most erroneous statements. And so what I really thought would be worthwhile, at least on an introductory type of a level, as you pointed out, Don, would be to introduce some realistic, down-to-earth fundamentals having to do with energy and power and that type of stuff, so that perhaps people can start to realize that it makes a very, very big difference which words you choose when you are describing systems or concepts or even theories involving these parameters. Because every word is defined not only in the verbal sense, but also mathematically and dimensionally. And it makes all the difference in the world when you really understand this stuff, as opposed to when you just throw out words that sound good. For instance, so many people that you hear talking in these areas tend to use force, work, power, energy, all these different terms interchangeably, as if they're all the same thing. And, of course, they're absolutely different. So, well, with the intention of at least making you aware of the fact that these important concepts exist and that they are fundamental to any worthwhile investigation and should be understood, you know, in great detail, I just thought it would be interesting to throw out some basic information and then delve into some specific definitions and then go a little bit further into where this leads if you really become proficient with its use. And so, to get on with that agenda, in the realm of physics, there are three basic systems. And I understand nowadays, incidentally, there's another one, but I'm not familiar with it, so I'm not going to go there. But there are three basic systems which are used to describe and utilize the laws of physics. The first is the English system, which essentially makes use of pounds for measurement of force, feet for measurement of distance, and seconds for measurements of time. The second one is the MKS system, which makes use of kilograms for force, meters for distance, and seconds for time. And the third system is the CGS system, which makes use of grams, centimeters, and seconds. And these systems all incorporate the following rudimentary parameters with which all of the classical and even some of the relativistic laws of physics are presented, utilized, and manipulated. And I won't get into you in any specific order, but I'll mention at least 10 of them. The first is force. Then we have velocity, displacement, or distance, as some people would like to call it, acceleration, impulse, momentum, work, energy, power, and time. And those that I just related to you are usually considered in the linear realm or the translational realm, but they also have angular equivalents. And if we look at the angular equivalents, then we have torque, angular velocity, angular displacement, angular acceleration, angular impulse, angular momentum, angular work, angular kinetic energy, rotational power, and of course time. The ones which are usually confused more than anything else is force, distance, work, energy, and power. And for anybody who's trying to pride themselves on doing original energy research, it's really a shame if they are not absolutely familiar with these particular concepts. Now, force, which in the English system is measured in pounds, is actually the product of mass and acceleration. And in the English units, that's slug feet per second squared, where slugs is a measurement of mass, and feet per second squared, of course, is acceleration. In the MKS system, it's kilograms, meters per second squared, which happens to be equal to a newton. And by the way, a lot of these things are named after various physicists and researchers down through the years who are being honored by having their names given to these various parameters. And so if you recognize names like Newton, Joule, and things of that sort, that's why they're in there. Returning back to the list here, distance, of course, is measured in feet, but it can also be measured in meters or centimeters, depending on which system you choose to embrace. The concept of work is measured in foot-pounds, and a foot-pound can be described as a slug foot per second squared times feet, or slug feet squared per second squared. And the reason I'm going through these dimensions is because you may not know this up front, but the dimensionality of a physical equation is actually more important than the numerical solution, because it's easy to crunch numbers. You multiply this times that, you divide by something, you take the square root, etc., etc. But you can crunch numbers all day long, get the wrong answers, if you don't have a full understanding of the dimensionality of what it is that you're setting up in your equations, and how those particular parameters wind up being equal or not equal to what you're looking for. And, of course, power can be measured as foot-pounds per second or joules per second, where a joule is actually a newton meter. And, of course, we already defined the newton as a kilogram meter per second squared. So these are some of the basic parameters that physicists and engineers use in their computations. And if you really understand this stuff, it's almost impossible, for instance, to haphazardly exchange the use of the word force for work, or force for energy, for instance, because their dimensions are entirely different. And you'll never get the right answer to whatever it is you're investigating if you choose to do that. Now, another area where you have lots of mistakes of this type is in the electrical arena. And in the study of electricity, magnetism, charge, and all of those types of things, it can get pretty confusing, especially if you don't really know the definitions of the things you're working with. For instance, I hear people confuse some really basic stuff all the time, like watts and kilowatt hours, for instance, or is another one that they seem to mistake all the time, which is the difference between resistance and impedance. You know, and these are things which are all governed by an understanding of mechanics, because, believe it or not, even though you're talking about electrical phenomenon, the rudimentary definitions of these electrical parameters are actually forthcoming from various measurements and observations made in the realm of mechanics. And to some people, this is very confusing. Like, for instance, if you take a charged particle and you move that particle into an electric field towards another charge, you have to do a certain amount of work, especially if the charges are of the same polarity, and you have to do a certain amount of work to push that charge against the other charge. And so you have a test charge, and you're moving that against a charge that you want to measure the intensity of, and you know the distance involved, and you can measure the forces. And believe it or not, that's a work function, which can be expressed as a potential or a potential gradient, which then, once you bring distance into the picture, becomes translated into a voltage, because a voltage is a measure of work done per unit charge. So you have to understand all these things before you can really get a feel for what's going on. And while I'm not trying to throw cold water on anybody's research, I just think that if anybody's doing serious work in any kind of field where there's the expectation of a very novel result for your efforts, if you cannot express what you're doing in terminology that is acceptable to the rest of the scientific community, you won't even be listened to. It doesn't make any difference if you have the answer to all of mankind's woes and blues. If you can't present it succinctly with equations, definitions, and dimensions which are acceptable and which are the building blocks from which everything else that we enjoy in the technical world has sprung, then you will be ignored. So, Don, before I continue on with any of this stuff, I would really like to hear some comments from you, because you always sit there very quietly, but I know those wheels are turning in your head.
Yeah, are they doing work, or are they producing force? That's the thing.
Well, we might be doing both in your case.
Yeah. One question that as you're speaking, and I keep getting these recollections of all these things I've been hearing through the various types of media about what's occurring in the Gulf, and I suppose you probably anticipated I would bring that up. And when we're being disinformed as to what is actually going on, what has occurred, and what is transpiring, and what may transpire. Certainly, listening to you give these definitions leads me to think that someone like yourself, or anyone like yourself, not just you, but anyone who understands this and accepts these principles as truths, are going to look at what's happening in the Gulf basically with the same eyes. In other words, they're going to be able to look at the data, make these calculations according to the principles that you're describing, and come up with the same data. Of course, if the data that we're given is hodgepodge, sort of a potpourri of propaganda, if you want to call it that, or just disinformation, speculation, guesstimation, We certainly can't understand the gravity of what is occurring. No pun intended, by the way. So if we were to get accurate data, and knowing what geologists know and what physicists know and people like yourself that really have an experience, you know, across the board in different areas of science, particularly in power production, we're looking at something that that is really fundamental or almost primitive in one sense, which is having a devastating effect on the Earth. And at the same time, if we were to look at solutions, potential solutions to this, because if we have the correct data, we can determine what is actually going on, and we should be able to arrive at solutions. Do you see that as a scientific possibility, if scientists could put their knowledge and their experience together using these principles? And I realize you're being very basic and very general in a sense, but you're specifying the importance of using the proper language and using the proper data in respect to the proper language. You think that there could be a solution scientifically?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to define the word solution, because I can think of several solutions, some of which are going to be pleasing and some of which are going to be displeasing mm-hmm. to the people expecting an outcome. There will be a natural solution to this. However, if we wait for it, we may not like what it involves. As far as man-made solutions are concerned, I know for a fact that there are plenty of people in various parts of the world, and just off the top of my head, I would say a good example would be Holland. Another excellent example would be Russia, and I'm sure that there are other places where this type of thing has been encountered before, perhaps not to this magnitude, but nonetheless, something similar. And it has been dealt with efficiently and with immediacy, simply because of the fact that they do realize the gravity of the situation, where you've got a compound or a series of compounds, a flammable mixture, if you will, which is conceived as being precious by the world, since everything is basically running on it right now. But the flip side of that coin is that same stuff can also destroy the world if it's released into the ecological system with enough volume and if it's released quickly enough, it's possible to do damage that we can't recover from. Now, from what I've heard from at least three sources, the Russians have already looked at the situation in the Gulf, and they have warned that the entire area is fracturing already because of the release of this pressure, and that if they don't do something, there's going to be one of those natural solutions that I mentioned, which we may or may not like. They suggested nuking the hole, which they had done apparently at least two or three times somewhere in the North Country there, where they do their own drilling. And another solution was suggested by the Dutch, and they said that they would guarantee that they could cap that well, or at least stop the flow, within 24 hours if they were given of free rein to do so, and they were told to mind their own business. So when you hear stuff like that, unfortunately, it pries the whole thing away from the arena of scientific solution and makes you realize that there has to be political agendas afoot. And, you know, once you get into that whole area, it's purely speculative, unless you've got a fly on the wall in the inner sanctum where these things are discussed, because there's no doubt in my mind that something could have been done a long time ago if they really wanted to do it. Just policing the area and riding around in boats and cleaning the weeds on the shoreline with absorbent pads doesn't do very much when you've got an oil slick that's larger than the state of Pennsylvania. You know, it's just common sense. But returning to what you asked me, I would say, consider this. You have an average water depth in that area of about 3,000 to 5,000 feet. Water is really heavy. Then you go down 30,000 or so feet into the crust of the earth before you reach this oil reservoir. And, of course, that represents untold tons of weight bearing down on this cavity. And I mentioned in another show that the normal procedure, once you're lucky enough to tap into a reservoir of that size, of course, is to draw off the crude oil for production purposes at a nominal rate, controlled rate. And it usually lasts years. In this case, I think it's been estimated that the amount of oil that's down there could run this country for 35 years or so. That's a lot of oil. And so if you were taking that out, you know, in the normal amount that an ocean platform can produce, and I don't know what that is, but it's certainly a lot less than the flow of 5 million gallons a day that they're incurring now. The rock strata in the surrounding areas over the years will weep water into that same cavity as the oil is displaced, and the pressure will neutralize, and the whole thing will more or less reach a stasis during the course of its operation. The fact that this oil is rushing out of there with this untold volume and in such, you know, quantity over a reasonably short period of time is releasing that pressure, which is generated not just by gas. You know, a lot of people think it's just the gas that's down in the hole that can give you this enormous pressure of, 105,000 pounds per square inch. But you have to remember that above that pocket, you have 30,000 feet of rock strata and another 5,000 feet of water, all of which weighs unbelievable amounts. I don't even know what the figures would be. And that's bearing down on this cavity, compressing this gas that's in there and supplying, you might say, doing work upon, you know, the materials that are in there and forcing it to come up and out of there. Well, as the crude oil is leaving and the pressure begins to drop, sooner or later, that hole is going to clear itself because the ceiling is going to collapse. I mean, it's already fractured all over the place, according to the Russians that went down and looked at it in submersibles. And so the real question is, if it's 30,000 feet down and it collapses upon itself in just the right way, it'll probably plug the leak. But there's also a possibility that something we can't anticipate might happen, and that would result in, you know, a huge release of oil. I would pray that that doesn't happen. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for a natural solution, the obvious is occurring, and that is that we have 5 million gallons of oil a day rushing out of there, and it's just filling up the whole area of the Gulf of Mexico. We know the catastrophic effect it's having on life and on property and on tourism and on fishing and on the animals and plants, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, there are solutions, but you have to want to obtain them. And I guess I should leave it at that.
Yes. Well, I was speaking more in a cooperative scientific arena, and you know, there may be possibly some solution. It's a simple deed that caused this. Now it's caused lots of complexities, and the problem is becoming increasingly complex because, in a sense, nothing's been done about it. It's certainly not stopped. I got information yesterday there were actually 32 fractures in the Gulf region, not just counting this gaping hole from the infrastructure of the well that has basically blown open and apart. I'm with you that if something was intended to be done, they would be working feverishly. I see a lot of posturing. I see a lot of finger pointing. The whole world sees this. What they put in place at the outset was a mechanism through the financial community to reap billions, if not even trillions of dollars from this. So somebody's making money, and as long as they're making money on this, and it doesn't really make any sense to the average person how that could be while this is going on, but that's part of the problem. They're not in any hurry to come to a solution. Now, you have people in Congress making ridiculous statements. Well, we know they're going to have this problem handled in 2 months. Well, they said that 2 months ago, or in a month and a half. They said that 2 months ago. And now they're predicting another month and a half, 2 months. They're not really giving any date. Well, it's the dates they're giving out are pertaining to how much money they're making. That has nothing to do with the remediation of the problem, the actual application of scientific principles to deal with this. We seem to be very proficient at destroying the earth and incompetent when it comes to repairing it. And I'm sure you would agree. So that was the nature of my question. Not so much, I understand that the Russians actually used 6 nukes on 6 wells on land that had the same problem. And most of this occurred back around 2004. I don't know the exact date of all the incidents, but I do know that they drilled past 40,000 feet where they had these types of problems. So they're not telling us the true amount of the oil. They're not telling us the true depth that they've drilled. They're not telling us the truth about anything. And I was basically just saying, if you could calculate what's really going on, if we have the actual data, are there things that we could do, even outside of, exploding a nuke, to remediate this situation? And I know that's a very speculative kind of question, but I would think that if we can do things like go out into space and move massive amounts of construction materials to other planets, that certainly we could do something to fix this problem, and that there are technologies that would at least stop the damage that's occurring to the ecosystem. And, prayer. Prayer is another answer. But anyway, I think you got the gist of what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, I did. And I wasn't trying to be evasive, Don. I was simply saying that the people who have offered to help must, in fact, have solutions in mind, because otherwise it's difficult to make a statement like, well, we could stop that leak in 24 hours if you let us. Now, I am anything but an oil engineer. And so, I can't tell you what the most intelligent solutions are, but I do know that whatever was offered so far has been declined. And if this was looked upon in the true spirit of an emergency, I would imagine that rather than declining something right off the bat, you do some serious investigating and check out what methods have been used in the past and what is the probability of success and all this type of stuff. You don't just say no, mind your own business.
Yeah.
The Russians mentioned that we should probably nuke this well, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, the reply they got was, well, if we nuke it, we can't sell it, so we're not going to do that. So, meantime, the oil is oozing out all over the place, or I should say gushing out all over the place. And the only thing I see happening is lip service and you know, conferences behind closed doors and nobody really knows what's happening. But it does appear that the American people are displeased and that a certain amount of clamor is being directed toward the White House, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, oh, my God. You know, you almost have to ask the rhetorical question, who are they going to sell it to? Who's going to be left to sell it to? You know?
I did ask that question. You know, I said, well, where is their thinking? You know, where is their brain at? You know, if the results of this are as bad as they could be, there's not going to be anybody around who's going to want their oil. And they won't be around to sell it either. But, of course, they don't think that far ahead.
Yes. Okay, well, that's it for my questions right now. You know, here we are depending on an energy source that puts this planet in peril. To me, it sounds a bit insane. It's quite obvious. It's been insane for many, many years. It's been the main factor in air pollution. Oh, blame it on the people that drive the cars and the trucks, you know, all the vehicles, the people that run the gas-powered lawnmowers. Blame it on us. Tax us for it when it's your invention. You get my meaning.
Well, of course. Well, the object of this whole thing was, I mean, my presentation was to lead up to, you know, a cogent and intelligent way of discussing that very issue. Because there are certain aspects of this type of physics which are deemed almost sacred. And I've talked about it on your show before, you know, quite a few times, the idea of the conservation of energy situation. And while I have no problem with conservation of energy, I use it myself all the time. The thing that people become almost nuts over is that they immediately assume that if you had a system that was over 100% efficiency in its operation, that would have to mean that you're creating energy. And that's a violation of the laws of conservation of energy, and so nobody goes there. But in reality, that isn't true. And that's the whole purpose of learning all these definitions and understanding all this stuff in great detail, because basically what it teaches you is that you can have systems in which energy is conserved and work is not, for instance. You can have systems in which energy is conserved, but there is a gain in power. And I'm not talking about an instantaneous gain, because, you know, there's such a thing as a instantaneous power peak or power surge, which is greater than the source power. But there are a whole series of very unusual, and I must stress, nonlinear functions in which you see very, very bizarre results. And I know for a fact that the Russians appreciate this, because years ago I sent for a translation of a very exciting paper that was produced in the University of Moscow. And if they're listening, I would give anything to go there and study, let's put it that way, because their attitude is totally different, you know, from the conventional way of looking at things. These guys had produced a resonant circuit in which there was no voltage source. Now, just so people understand what the heck I'm saying here, if you have a normal phenomenon involving electrical resonance, or what we call frequency resonance, which would be the proper design of a tank circuit so that it maximized its current flow at a particular frequency. That is usually perceived as being achieved by having a voltage source, an AC source at a given frequency, in series with a capacitor and an inductor combination, which are the values of which are calculated to achieve this resonance. And then, of course, what happens is at that particular frequency, your amperage just becomes enormous, and the voltage across the two components builds to a very, very high value. Anyway, the Russian paper was really amazing because what it said was that if you have a resonant circuit with no voltage source, which means you now have a capacitor and an inductor in series, and you vary either the capacitance or the inductance at the resonant frequency, that you will actually get an enormous current flow without a voltage. And the interesting thing is, if you do it properly, and properly means if your mechanical excitation is timed with the electrical resonant result, that you can achieve this with almost no work at all, and yet you're producing an enormous flow of current, and you can use that current for something. So this type of stuff represents really interesting thinking, but the mathematics that is behind the solution to those types of problems in which you've got resistance, inductance, and capacitance at a particular frequency, and one of those parameters is time varying, they're incredibly complicated to solve. And the interesting thing about it is they're totally nonlinear. And linearity in the engineering world has its place, but the problem is that there are very many situations, well, a very good example is in magnetics, where you have a basic concept, for instance, like permeability of a magnetic material. By nature, it's very nonlinear. But it's possible to look at a portion of it which is linear, and then confine your design parameters to that linear portion so that you can get very predictable results. The problem is that they are a subset of reality. They're not a true window. They don't represent a true window into the real world. And by taking these shortcuts of linearizing stuff, a lot of engineers fall into the trap of believing that the results that they see from artificially linearized systems are not only real, but the only results obtainable. And that's a very grave error. If you look at the way the real world operates, and I don't care if you want to look at ripples in a tank of water, or the way the wind blows, or the heating effect of the sun on the surface of the planet, or any number of other things that you care to direct your attention to, almost nothing's linear. You know, the whole world is a nonlinear and fractal arrangement, the complexity of which defies imagination. And I understand that we are limited creatures and we have to take certain shortcuts to allow us to understand things, but we must never lose sight of the fact that we are inventing these shortcuts and they don't represent a true picture of what's really happening. So getting back to the idea of alternative power sources, you are never going to find any magic, and I use that word in quotes, in a system that's totally linear. And unfortunately, that's where people have a tendency to look because that's what they're most familiar with. if you are familiar with Tesla's work, for instance, it couldn't be any less linear than, you know, your imagination wouldn't even begin to believe how nonlinear stuff is. As a matter of fact, his own uncle or nephew or somebody, I forget who it was, that analyzed the magnifying transmitter in modern times made the comment that the systems were so complicated that if you didn't know exactly what he had in mind, you could never figure out the solution because there are just there are too many isoclines involved and too many potential mathematical solutions. It would just take you forever to try all of them. And that's the way the real world functions. So my intent in making that little presentation at the beginning was to try and stress the importance that you can't just say, you know, arbitrarily use these words interchangeably. They all have real specific meanings, and each one of them has a dimensionality. And when you solve these equations, you must not only get the proper numerical answer, but you must also get the proper dimensional response to what you're doing.
Well, yeah. If I can comment, you know, I often draw analogies to these principles that you're discussing to my own experiences in music. And we could take the conversion from analog music production to digital synthesis and manipulation and processing, and then reverting it back to analog, and you can remove certain analog characteristics that actually have an effect on the multidimensionality of let's say the sound of an acoustic instrument or the sound of a human voice or the sound of a whole orchestra or any musical group for that matter, in that in synthesizing and in emulating, artificially emulating certain types of effects, you can create some pretty surreal images in sound. But one wonders what overall impact they have, because we're touching upon certain aspects of multidimensionality that may not resonate with our true core, our true being. In other words, these could be dissonance, or we could be removing important frequencies of the sound that would nurture better health or consciousness, for example. And I think to a large extent that's intentionally being done to us in the styles of music, how certain styles of popular music have evolved and the things that are put in there to direct one's consciousness in a particular area away from the heart and more into the head or even into just space with no definitive destination in mind. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but...
You're making yourself very clear. As a matter of fact, although music is certainly not my area of expertise, I do have an interest in it. And interestingly enough, there was a gentleman earlier on in my life who was very much into music. He was not only an electrical engineer, but he was an opera singer, and he studied under Caruso when he was a young man. And... he used to show me the most amazing experiments with his sound equipment. He had amplifiers, great big tube amplifiers that used things like AU3 tubes and, you know, real primitive but very high power triodes and pentodes. And the fidelity was unbelievable. I mean, between his ability to match the output impedance to the speakers and the size of the speakers in the room and whatnot, the fidelity, I mean, if you closed your eyes, you'd think you were listening to a real concert. But yeah. Then if he switched the same exact equipment, the phonograph was the same, everything else was the same, and he put a modern solid-state amplifier in there, the difference was like night and day. And one of the reasons that he claimed that that was happening was because in these giant tubes, the electrons actually have a drift velocity, and they can move in the space of that tube with such speed and such response to the plate voltages that that they pick up nuances and tiny little acoustical characteristics and transmit that to the output section. Whereas when you do this in a solid state or a power transistor, which is less than a 16th of an inch thick, the electrons may move the same way, but they don't have all the velocity characteristics, and there's no way that you can make them appear simply because of the fact there's no room for them to wiggle that way. And so, you know, that's a certain example of what you were saying. You know, you can comb certain things out of a system either deliberately or inadvertently, and you may think you have something that sounds great or behaves in a wonderful manner, but it's actually totally different from the natural solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's artificial and contrived in a way that may actually be causing some harm to the body, or the mind, or the soul itself.
Might just sound terrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's the first thing. You know, when digital electronics first came out, everybody said, you know, it sounds kind of harsh and raspy in a sense. There's a certain coldness to it. It lacks warmth. And they've gotten into what you could call waveform modeling or modeling synthesis, where they take a pulse and they put a code on that pulse, and that pulse represents the one note on a piano or one note on a guitar or one note on a flute or a violin. You pick your instrument, and then they shift that frequency. In the beginning, that's how they made all digital keyboards, and they sounded sort of hokey. Some people said, oh, doesn't that sound just like a piano? Well, it sounded nothing like a piano. But as they got better at it, and they realized that the sampling rate at a higher frequency would pick up more of the colors and the timbres of the various instruments, that they were able to fine tune this until you know, you could put the sound of a grand piano in a very tiny space, and have that interact with the computer and with other types of recording devices. But still, we hear with our ears, you see. And you mentioned Pavarotti, and, you know, he had a sibilance to his voice that no one can imitate. No singer can imitate that sibilance electronically. Yet they're doing that now with a lot of pop singers. These people are not, they don't sound anything like their recordings. If you were to
John, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here. Are you not hearing me?
I don't know. For a minute, you just were gone. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I was talking about the sibilance factor of a natural singer, and that they're imitating this in recordings. Particularly, they do it a lot in country music, where they're almost robotizing the voice, you see, making it sound less human. And so the dimensionality is being shifted to a different reality, is what I'm getting at, other than what is natural. So it puts us out of tune with the grid. And then here we have these energy sources that we're using to produce power in all kinds of ways. And we're getting, again, I think we're not resonating with what's natural in the universe. We're actually impeding it.
Well, I would love to expound upon that very concept. You know, it would take a lot of shows to do it, simply because of the fact that there's a lot of things that need to be explained. But there is a hierarchy in the universe which has to do with time and with other parameters. which interrelates all of the various, I guess I have to use the word parameters, that we are so used to, and which actually makes them different from one another. And I've spent a lot of time understanding and investigating what these things are, and the most interesting thing is that you can see it very, very plainly if you have a well-developed intuition. You can see it very, very plainly in the world of mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I did was I used that as a stepping stone to move over into the less obvious world of electrostatics and electromagnetics. And I can tell you unequivocally that there is so much out there that we should be focusing our attention on that would give unlimited amount of power for very little effort. And what I mean by effort is, I mean the input to the system can be quite small, and the system can have a very large gain. And it doesn't violate any laws of nature, because if it did, you couldn't do it. You know, that's the most absurd thing about all this. People say, well, it's a violation of the laws of this or that. Well, if it really was, I guarantee you it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have something that's working, that you can measure and reproduce at will, then it can't be violating anything. It just simply means that somebody has come up with something which is either outside the box, or if it's still inside the box, then it has to represent a mechanism that was not thoroughly understood or not dreamt up previously, because you're getting these very different results.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a certain measure, I think, Don, of man's arrogance to say that certain things are impossible in the known universe, because we don't know a damn thing about the universe. I mean, for all the years we've been on Earth struggling to understand ourselves and the creation around us, what we've learned, as voluminous as it may seem, could fit on the head of a pin with respect to what's left to understand. And so I think it's a very arrogant and unrealistic thing to say that there are no other options, there are no other avenues of exploration left. That's just another attempt at disinformation and lying, because there's an infinite number of paths left. And we have the intelligence and the creativity to explore those paths. But what we're lacking is the support, which instead of going to those worthwhile endeavors, go to support the lives of so-called elite, who have never accomplished anything except the enslavement of humanity.
Yeah. When, you know, when we talk about these things, Jim, what goes through my mind is that there's a dissonance that's going on. You know, it's been called a cognitive dissonance. And when we put out dissonance into the universe, we get that back, in a sense. It's not that the universe chooses to do that, but the universe responds to what we are actually doing. It doesn't make judgments on it. It takes it literally. And it's like our intention. You know, I've told people that we can, you know, they can change the weather technologically, artificially, with all this technology that's being misused. And if it destroys and wreaks havoc, it's destructive. There's no mincing words with that. And if it creates fear or causes people to move into fear who are not fearful, it's being misused, because the universe doesn't operate that way. And we can affect these things with our consciousness. We can affect it with our intention. We can affect these things with our, even with our prayer, because it's a way for us to resonate with the universe rather than impede what's coming through or filtering it out. Basically, our consciousness, on this planet has been filtered, and all the good things about the creation, I feel, have been filtered and distorted in some manner. You'd probably agree with me on that.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, we've talked about that before. The best proof I can think of to demonstrate the validity of that is just look at the layout of any city. There's absolutely nothing natural about it. I mean, it fulfills a particular need, and it's got certain aspects of it which have to exist simply because, by definition, that's what constitutes a city. But if you grow up in one, and you really begin to believe that artificial environment represents the real world, that's the same kind of a warping of consciousness and a chipping of the reality that we've been talking about from the scientific point of view. The same thing happens in the scientific realm.
Mm-hmm.
And the consciousness becomes retarded under those conditions.
Yeah.
I've had the good fortune of seeing how more natural people actually behave when they're in a more natural environment. And it's unbelievable. I mean, you can take an Aborigine and stand them next to a modern person from the city, and there's very little difference in appearance between the two beings. But as far as their ability to intermesh with the real natural environment, you can turn the Aborigine loose in the jungle or in the outback or wherever he's from, and he'll do just fine. But the city slicker will perish. Of course, the reverse is true, too. Don't get me wrong. But that's not the point. The point is that our civilization has been taken out of the natural environment to such an extent that we can't even realize, we don't consciously realize what we're missing. I think that there are times when people feel it, and they realize that something's wrong with their lives and something's missing from their lives. But then instead of exploring that, they reach for a can of beer, turn on the TV set, and rip open a bag of potato chips, and they say, well, there's a game on, I'll let it slide. And that's how we get through life. We slide through, and we miss the whole purpose of being alive in the process.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I can explain my thoughts on this golf thing by just saying, you know, the Earth has a fracture or multiple fractures in its crust. Certainly in the Gulf of Mexico. Don't mean the slight New Mexico here. So there is a fracture in that aspect of the universe, and how we handle this. And how we allow this to continue on keeps affecting the rest of the universe. And either the universe is going to respond appropriately, and that could become more disastrous than it is now. It appears that that's sort of how things work in the universe, or that we can put intention on it and some meaningful effort that the universe would respond in kind and assist us in the process of overcoming this devastation that's occurring. Because the universe is suffering along with us, whether we're aware of that or not. And I don't mean to sound like a space cadet in saying that, but that's the reality. If what you're saying is true, that's the reality. There's a dissonance that we're emitting out into space, into the outer realms of the universe, and the universe is hearing it and feeling it and responding to it. And you know, it's sort of like we're committing suicide and because it's a free will universe, the universe is allowing that to occur. Any comment?
Well, I agree with you. You know, the universe is a conscious entity, just like a plant, or just like our planet itself. And so, when something's wrong, that's transmitted out there, and you know, it's almost like a prayer. Now, there can be good prayers and there can be bad prayers. As you pointed out, the universe is capable of answering either one. So the intent right now is to capitalize on this situation. You know, no, what's the expression they always say? No catastrophe goes without being capitalized upon, or something like that.
Yeah, take advantage of a bad situation.
Yeah. Turn it into money, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, that transmits a certain attitude. And it's just like what we talked about a month or so ago with Clay Baxter's experiments with living things, you know.
Yes.
When you broil the brine shrimp, the plants feel it. You know, when the guy chops the plant up with the hedge cutters, the other plants are aware of what happened, and they recognize the guy the next time he comes in. Well, you know, when you blow up an oil platform and you let that stuff bleed out all over the place, and you've got tens of thousands of creatures dying in agony, there are other entities which feel that. And the people that are behind all this may not care, and they may not feel anything except, you know, the bulging wallets in their pocket. But we shouldn't be surprised if something really negative happens if this is allowed to go on, because you're asking for it, basically. That's exactly what we're doing.
Yes. Well, Jim, we're out of time. Certainly, we could go on for hours more. I know your stamina in this area, and it is very enlightening, very interesting, and I think we should talk about these things some more in the very near future.
Well, I would like to do that, because I started to mention about the hierarchy that exists in the universe, and how that ties in with the dimensionality of the concepts that are utilized in physics. And, of course, we didn't get anywhere near that, but it's still there to be explored, and I think it would be a neat thing to find an intelligent and succinct way of sharing that concept with people, because that apparently is how the universe works, and some of the earliest civilizations on Earth were much more in tune with that concept than we are. For instance, sacred geometry that was used by the Egyptians, for instance, and the Babylonians and the Sumerians, is an attempt to lock a particular civilization into the structure of the universe so that it can prosper by making use of these higher forces. And, you know, people listen to that and think it's a lot of mumbo-jumbo, but it's actually no different, for instance, than cooking your food in a microwave oven. I mean, it's just a question of what you know and how you decide to use that information.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you. Now, it's we have a holiday coming up here, Sunday, Father's Day. And so I want to wish you a happy Father's Day. I know you're a father. And any fathers out there listening, happy Father's Day. And to those who choose not to reveal their true identities, I have a song I want to play here before we close out the show. It's not to demean Father's Day, but just for the listeners to contemplate who this might be.
Many, many years ago when I was 23, I was married to a widow who was pretty as could be. This widow had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her and soon they two were wed. This made my dad my son-in-law and changed my very life. For my daughter was my mother cause she was my father's wife. To complicate the matter, even though it brought me joy, I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. My little baby then became a brother-in-law to dad, and so became my uncle, though it made me very sad. For if he was my uncle, then that also made him brother to the widow's grown-up daughter, who of course was my stepmother. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It's a funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. My father's wife then had a son who kept him on the run. And he became my grandchild cause he was my daughter's son. My wife is now my mother's mother and it makes me blue. Because although she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. If my wife is my grandmother, then I am her grandchild. And every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild.
This has got to be the strangest thing I ever saw.
As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. Everybody! I'm my own grandpa. It's so funny, I know, but it really is so. Hey! I'm my own grandpa.
That goes out to all our politicians in Washington, D.C. Jim, want to wish you, if you're still with us, want to wish you a happy Father's Day. I had to lighten up the mood of this show tonight, although it was very informative. You know, we have the realization of this massive catastrophe bearing down upon us, and we could be spending some time over the weekend contemplating this responsibility we have, and we can pray to our Father in heaven. We can pray that we are delivered from this, despite the intentions of those I just described in this song. And my own father passed away some 14 months and 19 days ago, and I still love my dad. And if you love your dad, tell him. Jim, thank you so much. I look forward to you being on the show next week.
Thank you, Don. I'll be back.
Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and tonight's special guest, Jim Murray. Special thanks to Windtalkers Radio Network and BlogTalkRadio.com for broadcasting this show. Also want to thank Seth Hendrick on the sound. Happy Father's Day, Seth. Also, Don and Doug Newsom. Don, happy Father's Day to you. And also, you out there in the listening audience, thank you so much for tuning in. Join me next week on Monday night when my special guest will be Dr. H. Huat. In the meantime, I wish everyone a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light. And have a good night.